Back to our regularly scheduled programming here on Hollinger & Duncan, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, joined by John Hollinger of The Athletic, who pays for him to travel to and fro. So we got a lot to talk about what he has seen this week. Where did your travels take you this week, John?
Well, I went to lovely Sacramento, California.
People shit on Sacramento. I really like Sacramento, actually.
Used to be the most feared road trip in the league when Arco was a dump and it was outside of town and there was just nothing compelling about going there at all. And that new arena is, if it's not the best arena in the league, it's definitely in the top five. I mean, it's awesome for anyone who hasn't been there. They did a really great job with it. All kinds of, like, even as far as like the fan experience, because I walked around the concourse the last couple times I've been there, all the food options and stuff, and the concourses are really wide. They have this big glass opening that faces outside on the one end. And it can like open up, like it allow fresh air in, which is really cool. So they did a great job with that. And then it's right in the middle of downtown. There's some other stuff that's come up around it, so it's a much more pleasurable trip than it's used to have been.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, people in the Bay Area like love to crap on Sacramento just because it's not the Bay Area. And
the thing they should crap on though is that drive from the Bay Area to Sacramento. Like if that road were actually paved, it would be a much more enjoyable trip.
Yeah, no, it's there's a little bit of traffic there. It's not good. But I mean, I'm not a huge fan of some of the cities to the south of Sacramento in the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. But Sacramento itself, I think I read it has the most trees of any city in the country. There's like actual neighborhoods. There's pretty good ethnic food. I mean, there's not like super high end stuff, but like how often are you eating at that kind of stuff anyway? You could go to Napa or the Bay if you really need it. And it is the most integrated city in the country as well, as opposed to the most diverse, the most integrated with
really
people of different races actually like living interspersed with one another, as opposed to like Chicago, which you can draw red lines through.
I mean, Atlanta's like that too. I mean, Portland
Not relevant for NBA people, but 2 hours away from skiing in Lake Tahoe too.
So it's almost like they got lost on their way to Canada or something.
So let's talk about a team that's been lost on its way to really nowhere for the last, like, oh gosh, I guess 9 years or so now. The Phoenix Suns, you wrote about them this week, not necessarily taking as much of a long-term view of them, but just talking about whether the start they had, they started 7-4, they've lost three straight. So is it just, all right, they had this nice start. Now it's back to same old Suns again. They're going to crater and not be in the playoff mix. Or do you think they're going to stick around all year?
I think they're going to stick around all year. And looking at the West right now, I think they might actually make it. Like when you look at some of these other teams that would potentially be challenging them for a playoff spot, I think they have a lot more problems than the Suns do.
Yeah. I mean, when you're looking at Portland,
San Antonio.
It
looks like a complete mess. When you look at even these teams, you know, Minnesota, who they just beat in their building without Baines or Rubio.
I think the Wolves are kind of doing it with smoke and mirrors to me more than the Suns are at this point even.
Yeah. The Pelicans, you still figure will make a run when they get Zion back, but they're a few games behind now. Sacramento has never really made the kinds of faces you'd expect a team to make if they were going to contend. It's just who's going to take it from them at this point? Like, I think there are six clear-cut teams at the top of the West, and then Phoenix has as good a better argument as anyone else right now.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, Clippers, Rockets, Nuggets, Lakers, Jazz, Mavs, to me, are pretty clearly looking in sans major injuries. You know, those are all looking like 50-win quality of teams. And then, it's looking, kind of around 500 after that. And now they are going to need to get healthy with Rubio and Baines. And I worry, I mean, those guys have been so important to what they've done defensively, in that game against New Orleans, which is a disappointing home loss because New Orleans has a ton of people out too. They're closing it with I don't know whether you're going to call Kelly Oubre or Mikal Bridges the center in that lineup they closed it with, but you know, Šarić, Kaminsky, I mean, that's not getting it done. So, and Baines and Rubio do not have the greatest of health records. They need those guys desperately.
Yeah, well, I mean, so on the Baines side, I mean, they'll at least have Ayton back in another 10 or 11 games here. But Rubio, they're really without a net there at the point. That was the reason that bringing him in was so important in the first place, because Phoenix point guard was arguably the worst position group in the league last year. Since overtaken by Golden State small forward, certainly, but at that time, that was a real disaster. So I think he solidified that and really allowed these other guys to play their normal game.
GR3 has been passable. I think he's been passable. I think if I really went through it, I could find a worse position group. Maybe
Trailblazer fours now without Zach Collins.
Yeah. That's not good. But Blazers fives is not looking amazing either.
yes.
yeah. So anything else that stuck out to you about this sudden start? I mean, specifically defensively, they really seem a lot better. Is there anything that looks unsustainable about that to you?
Not really. I mean, they have 8 to 10 solid guys. The biggest thing that's changed to me is Booker is playing real basketball now. He's like actually trying on defense. He's not taking crazy shots. He's always had the ability to pass, but he's playing more as a distributor now, even when Rubio was out. And it's just a basketball maturity, I would say, almost. And then Kelly Oubre, a little bit to the same extent. I mean, mental errors out the yin-yang when he was playing in Washington and even last year in Phoenix. And I think his game's tightened up a little too, where he's eliminated some of the negative plays so that his positives are more easily displayed.
Well, so what are some of the people that you talked to in Phoenix saying about the coaching staff? Was that who's getting a lot of the credit for this transformation, obviously, in addition to some of the personnel changes?
I mean, I think certainly Monty Williams is seen as a centerpiece to this, just in terms of somebody who had some gravitas to him and could come in and say immediately, this is how we're going to do things. We're going to be, you know, a real basketball team now and not the shit show that it's been for the last however many years. And I think him being a head coach before and having that experience and having been a player, and that's always been his reputation, that he has that ability to connect with guys, that maybe he's not the greatest on X's and O's, but that he can be somebody who really kind of galvanizes the troops and gets everyone rowing in the same direction. And so far, he's been able to accomplish that. And I think last year, you know, one of the problems I'm sure that Igor Kokoskov had was just coming into a situation as a first year head coach, and it wasn't stable right away. The GM that hired him was fired before he ever coached a game. So it was just unstable from game one. And there's just an appearance of stability now there. Monty got a 5-year deal. The new front office, whatever you think of it, is newly hired. So presumably not going anywhere for a little bit. So it just feels a little steadier there than it used to be.
Yeah, I agree with you. What do you think of the way they're using Booker off the ball more now? Is that better for him? I mean, his efficiency is way up, although he's shooting 46% from three, so that's probably going to come down at least a little bit. You know, last year he had the ball in his hands every chance he could get, every chance that they could get for him. Does it look better with him as more of an off-ball guy now?
Well, here's the thing. So I didn't see them with Rubio on this trip.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I gotta withhold my judgment a little bit, because without that real floor general, I mean, it still looked a little rickety. So I gotta withhold judgment because of that. The one thing I will say, which surprised me, the last couple games, Eli Okobo has actually looked like kind of an NBA player, which would have stunned anyone who saw him last season.
Yeah, I mean, he was drafted, what, was 31?
He was 31st pick, yeah.
In 2018. Yeah, I mean, that's a coveted pick normally. So I thought maybe even they were going to cut him. They had a little bit of a roster crunch, but haven't done that. And they've still gotten decent play out of Javon Carter.
Yes.
At least shooting the three ball, and then defensively, you know, we'll see what that really last or not. They claim that he's actually been shooting the ball really well for them going back to summer league and even, you know, in practices.
Well, you know, we had Javon Carter in Memphis last year. His shooting percentages last year were a fluke. Like, he can shoot. Like, you see him in practice and in the scrimmages and in the G League games. Like, he's a decent shooter. Like, that's not a part of his game that you doubt. The question is just with his size and ability to play the point and distribute for other people and the foul proneness on the defensive end.
Well, I mean, when I got, what was he, like 32% from the field and 27% from three or something like that last year. He played like a fair number of minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the numbers were really bad. And we were all scratching our heads because we'd see it. You have an idea in your head of what kind of practice performance correlates to what kind of game performance. And when you watch these guys shoot.
But when you say practice just being like, you know, not like actual live practices, but just like, you know, shooting around practice.
Yeah, when you watch guys shoot around and do drills, you sort of have in your head what the calibration is, and also just visually how it looks. You know, is the ball spinning correctly? Is it where are the misses? Yeah. You know, those kinds of things. And it was just stunning to see in the games that his threes especially just couldn't find the net. Now, his overall field goal percentage is probably always going to be a little low because he just doesn't get to the rim that much, so he's taking harder shots.
I mean, have you ever seen someone who just like could shoot it in practice and just never was able to get it together in the games?
I've always
wondered about that. Like, you know, I see guys shooting around and like, you know, those aren't all created equal, right? Like somebody goes, you know, Steph Curry is like going behind the back 30 times and, you know, shooting a three in his warmups, and other guys are just getting catch and shoots, you know, stand still, not even jumping. So, you know, they're not all created equal, but I've always wondered that of just like, is there really, you know, close to a 1-to-1? I mean, not 1-to-1, but, you know, 0.6-to-1 or whatever it is, translation between how you just shoot it when you're shooting around and how you shoot it in games.
The one guy who people might point to, I think, would be Ben McLemore. Cause if you get him in a workout, he looks like prime Ray Allen. And his shooting percentages in NBA games have never, even like on open threes, have never quite translated to that level. Like, he's been an okay shooter, right? But just nothing that blew you away.
Yeah, I mean, he was drafted to be like a 40% from three.
Absolutely, guy.
Well, we'll find out for real this year.
I mean, he's never going to have better looks than the ones he's going to get this year. Absolutely. So.
Yeah. Well, I guess now we can actually do a quick little. Actually, let's do a read real quick, and then we can introduce a new feature that we're going to try here. So we talked about it a little bit here. In past years, the Suns would have been a candidate for this right away. But we're going to start off, we're going to do this, I think, basically every week. We might have to skip a week or two, where John and I are each going to rule out a team for the playoffs every week and maybe talk about them a little bit too. And then we just have to do it, pick one each week, and then get to the end where you've only got 16 left. And see which of us ends up being closer as far as actually getting the playoff field. So I will go first here. And, you know, we can pick the same team, I suppose, if we want to. I guess it would have to be, I'm struggling between Hornets and Knicks. I think I'll go Knicks. They have a worse record, worse point differential. I'll go there. New York Knicks.
How can you rule them out with the talent that front office has amassed?
Are Steve Mills and Scott Perry going to play? Is that what you're talking about?
I just, you know, I mean, they seemed very convinced anyway. The interesting thing here is that you chose a team in the East.
Yeah, that might have been dumb, but I guess Warriors would be the other one, but that's the other potential candidate. But I mean, but you say the East, but. You know, I think 500, I mean, I guess the eighth seed in the East is going to be like, you know, 37 wins or something. It probably will be a little higher than that in the West. I didn't think the conference thing was that different. All right. So who are you going with? Warriors?
I think I have to go with the Golden State Warriors. Yeah. The only thing in the back of my head that was maybe pushing me to go in a different direction was the fact that, well, what if Steph comes back early and maybe, but I just think there's so many things working against them and they've been so bad in the early going that I mean, 3-14 is tough to recover from. You gotta, I mean, just to get to 500, right? You got to be 11 over the rest of the way.
Well, and anytime anybody has the slightest nagging injury, especially if it's Draymond Green, like they're going to sit for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's possible that like when Kevon Looney gets back, their defense could be passable with him, Draymond, Pascal, like the Kerr is kind of playing a little bit bigger. You just run everything through Russell at the point. Like, I guess their other problem is that they have like two guards and one of them is Jordan Poole, who might be the worst rotation player in basketball right now.
He has had a rough start.
I'm not sure
the middle and the end are going to be any better, but, but definitely a rough beginning.
Yeah, I think he's like third to last in Jacob Goldstein's PIPM and Cam Reddish, who it must privilege you to be able to watch him on a near nightly basis in Atlanta. Maybe that's why you're traveling so much. But
it's an avoidance strategy. Although, you know, he's missed the last couple of games, so I should have stuck with him. No, actually, the Hawks were on the road for like 2 weeks though, so this was a great time for me to travel. So I'm gonna see them against Minnesota on Monday night. So that'll be good.
Okay,
we digress.
I feel comfortable, pretty comfortable here with the New York Knicks. I mean, maybe Elfrid Payton comes back and really. All right, let's stop talking about this.
this feature will get more interesting as the year goes on.
So I haven't had a chance to talk about this yet. Zach Lowe and Woj had a report on some changes that the league is considering. I'm going to just take you through each one of these things that they're talking about here.
Sure.
Start with the and we can just hit on them. We'll talk about the easiest one, and that is the idea of reseeding once the conference finals rolls around. So basically you get four teams once the conference finals rolls around, and you reseed to have the team with the best and worst record play each other regardless of conference, and the teams 2 and 3 play each other regardless of conference. What do you think of that proposal?
I think it's pretty good. I think they want to get their best matchup in the finals if they can.
Yeah.
They want to get Golden State Houston in the finals if they can, rather than the conference finals. So I went back and looked at what had changed 6 of the last 10 matchups in the conference finals. So we would have ended up with something different. And in most cases, it was the Western teams, obviously, that were more advantaged by this. It will create more travel in the conference finals, and they may need to put in an extra travel day or two into the schedule to accommodate this, because the conference finals, unlike the finals, has been in every other, just a straight on every other for the first 6 games every year. So for a Portland-Miami series, let's say, that would be difficult to accommodate. So that's something they'll have to think about a little bit. And then you ask, well, why don't they do it for every round? The reason they wait to the conference finals is because now you don't have double headers. And so you don't have to worry as much about coordinating start times across time zones, where you can have an 8 and a 10:30 Eastern start or a 7 and a 9:30. There's just one game that day. It's just going to start when it starts.
Right.
So, I think that's the reason why you don't do it before the conference finals.
Yeah, and that I think that is something that might put even more of a premium, or I shouldn't say more of a premium because there's not enough of one run right now on the regular season to still have the overall be the overall NBA one seed. It seems like teams don't really emphasize that too much. And I mean, you might still get situations where really good teams are losing in the second round in the West, and maybe one team makes it, you know, like a 2017 Boston type of situation makes it in the East. But at least, yeah, this will help that a little bit. And you also still have the issue that, you know, now you're pitting teams for home court up against each other earlier who aren't playing the same schedules, or at least very close to the same schedules. But I think it's a good thing. Overall, I mean, it's just such a bummer when the finals is, you know, Golden State 4-0 over a decimated Cleveland team, you know, that kind of thing.
San Antonio, New Jersey, you know. That, yeah.
Yeah. So, and who knows? I mean, there could be times when it ends up being great series anyway in the conference finals, and then the finals aren't any good or whatever like that. You know, the seeding isn't going to make it perfect, especially because teams aren't trying as hard in the regular season as they used to. But
yeah, it'll, no, Nothing will make it perfect, but on balance, this is an improvement.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. Okay. Now they want to include a 30-team in-season tournament. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't hate it. I'm worried about how seriously teams will take it, especially in the beginning. It could be a glorified G League showcase, but I think it's a test for the idea that, because in concert with this, they're reducing the schedule to 78 games, right?
Yeah.
So the concept of fewer games, but more that matter, I think is one that they can dip their toe in the water with this. And then when they get to the next collective bargaining agreement in 2023, most likely, depending on whether one side opts out, that they will have some information that if they really want to look at shortening the schedule,
yes,
they'll have a better idea of how much they're costing themselves and or helping themselves. That the idea that less can be more, I think, has gained some currency in a lot of circles in the media and within the league. But I think there's still a reluctance to try that until there's some kind of proof of concept available. So this, yeah, in a very limited way, offers some of that. That will take 60 games off the schedule, you know, 34 games from 30 teams divided by two, 60 games off, and we'll add in their place just the quarterfinals, semifinals, finals of this tournament, this cup tournament, so 7 games in their place, and we might do better from those 7 games than we did from those original 60, just yeah, because they matter.
And they're going to have this play-in tournament potentially. So now keep in mind, none of this is going to happen for sure. I think there's a reason that this was kind of floated in the media as a trial balloon at this point. But I agree with you. I think a lot of people were like really disappointed, like, okay, 78 games, that's not enough. I've maintained for quite some time now it should be a 58 game home and home with every team season. But you can get rid of the conferences entirely, et cetera, et cetera. You can almost have it like a league schedule, winning the league type of thing. But that wasn't, just realistically wasn't going to happen. I am one of those people who thinks it probably would be better for the overall revenue pie. Certainly it would help, I think, national TV ratings, and definitely won't hurt them because you can still have just as many national TV games.
Absolutely. You're just, yeah.
Where it kills you is, in theory, is with the gate and then the RSNs who have the local TV rights. And, you know, there certainly would be an issue with contracts there when, you know, Warriors, you're going to be on national TV 30 games. Well, now you only have 28 games to show for the RSN instead of 50 games. Like that's a big problem, right? So that's something they would have to deal with. But I agree with you. I think that, every team having 2 games a week would be much better for fantasy as well, which, you know, has driven so much of the growth of the NFL. I'm hopeful that this is exactly what you said, dipping their toe in the water. I mean, how are they going to make people give a shit about this tournament though?
They just have to hope people give a shit about the tournament. I mean, you qualify for it via regular season games in your division. So because that's the biggest struggle FIBA has had, right? Is that nobody wants to play in the qualifying games.
Yeah.
And then, so the actual tournament you hope is prestigious enough and, that teams will take it relatively seriously. It's going to be an interesting question when you have half injured players, if they're going to want to play in that, or if teams are going to value regular season wins more than a win in the cup competition. So I think that's all up in the air, but it is a way for the NBA to get itself on the radar a little bit between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Well, and the Kings, remember, like, raised a banner for their summer league championship, right? I think, like, I don't know if they did it in the arena, but there are teams who like just have nothing to be happy about. I think those teams.
Well, and teams who don't have extended histories, like in Memphis, yeah, even though we had a pretty successful team most of the time, there's no laundry hanging from the ceiling. So yeah, winning that cup, they might take that very seriously.
I mean, how many like jewels and like platinum is like going to be on this actual cup? Maybe they just have to make the trophy really awesome. That's the way to make it interesting. But supposedly they had talked about, more cash incentives for the players as well to make them, you know, now, I mean, is it going to be $1 million a player? Like, is, you know, these guys make a lot of money, right? Like, there's not, you know, how much do you think it would take per player for a win to make it players actually care, like $500K per player?
Which player?
Yeah.
Right? The minimum guys? Oh, they're going to be balling out, man.
Yeah, but those guys are balling out all the time anyway.
Yeah, yeah, that's true, because their life depends on it, yeah.
Right, so, I mean, maybe you would just have a pool of, you know, $2 million, and it's prorated for each player's salary on the team or something like that, or you know. But, yeah, I mean, I think it would be tough to make the players who are playing in the finals every year care that much about it, especially this early in the season. I mean, maybe the thought is it's just like, it's so early in the season that everyone still has their summer legs, you know, like how yeah. Zach Lowe noted in his piece last year that, like, even compared to the playoffs, players move the fastest in the first 15 games of the season before they get worn out. So maybe, like, everyone will have enough energy and just be optimistic enough and just enjoying playing enough. It's not the dog days yet that they just want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is hopefully what might happen. Because there are other the leagues in Europe, they play cup competitions. They basically have two different cup competitions, but Spain and Serbia do their cup competition before the regular season even starts. That's like opening weekend.
Yeah.
And then they'll have another cup competition around the time that we do the All-Star game, because a lot of them don't have an All-Star game.
Yeah, Locke had an interesting idea that they're you should start the season overseas and play like little tournaments overseas and, you know, have like, you know, the Paris Cup winner with 8 teams or something like that. It went after expanding to 32 teams at, you know, the Tokyo Cup winner, et cetera. Like that's an interesting idea too. But yeah, I think this, I don't know. As I talk through it with you, I'm growing a little bit more enthused about it than I was when I first read it. I guess the question is, we don't have this tradition, you know, there's one championship in the US, right?
And
so, I mean, and now what you really would struggle with is, okay, if you went to the 58 game schedule, would winning the league mean as much here as it does in like the Premier League in soccer? You know, like, could you actually make that be actually mean something too and really have like the treble?
They don't have playoffs, so they don't have a choice.
Yeah.
In the Premier League in England. So, but can you make it like those cup competitions where maybe it's not as important as winning the championship, but it's still something. Like if you ask somebody who won the Premier League last year, they're not going to talk about who won the cup. They're going to talk about who ended up at the top of the standings at the end of the year, which I'm pretty sure was Manchester City, if I remember right. But nobody remembers as much who won the midseason cup, but it's still a thing.
Yeah. And I mean, and if we ever start talking about, most dominant regular seasons of all time, well, if you did have the best record in the league and you won the cup and you won the finals.
Yeah.
You know, that maybe that's like a little extra piece to talk about things historically now. And there's like a lot. I mean, I could name you 10 franchises right now who would be just so desperately happy. I mean, the Cavs PR staff was, you know, spent a ton of time pushing Colin Sexton for first team all rookie last year. Like all these teams, PR staffs like need something to do. Like they're looking for anything they can to celebrate. The local TV announcers, like they all would be so happy to just have anything here.
Yeah. So I don't remember seeing this I don't know if they figured this out. Would a cup competition be in one location or would it be in like different home court environments?
Yeah, because I haven't seen anything on that.
The travel and logistics change considerably because of that. But you also worry that if you invite 8 teams to Vegas and there's like, you know, crowds of like 2,411, you know, like what does that do? So I didn't see any details on that. I'm interested how they to do that.
I would be surprised if it weren't just at like, you know, a team just having home court advantage in it, because you're already taking away some home dates. So like, that's going to be a complaint. They're not going to want to lose more on that. You can also add some intrigue to these early season division games of just like, you know, are you going to qualify for this thing or not early on? So, all right, we'll talk about this last bit in a second here. Let's take another quick break. All right. Next proposal, the third major one here, play in tournament. Here's how it would work. 2 4-team tournaments with the 7th through 10th seeds in each conference. The 7th seed would first host the 8th seed, and the winner of that one game gets the 7th seed. Then the 9th seed would host the 10th seed. Winner of that game plays the loser of 7 versus 8 for the final playoff spot. So if you're the 9 or the 10th seed, you basically have to win 2 straight games to get in. If you're the 8th seed, you can go 1-1, or the 7th seed, you can go 1-1 and still get in.
Yeah. To me, the real target for that is tanking. That you're trying to put a carrot out there that even if you finish 10th, that you can get into the real playoffs and get some additional gate and some additional sort of credit for your team. Like, hey, we were a playoff team. So that to me is the real objective here. I mean, the play-in tournament might do okay. Like, there'll be excitement, right? They're winner-take-all games. So that'll add 6 exciting games onto the schedule at the end of the year, which I think will be fun. I presume it would take place over that kind of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, where we now have the first weekend of playoff games, and that those playoff games would be pushed back. Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
No, I that would very much surprise me if they wanted to lose opening the playoffs on that weekend. I'm guessing it would be they might just end the season a couple. I don't know this, but my guess would be that they wouldn't want to lose having those first 8 games all in a weekend the way it is. They really try to focus on having more games on the weekends in the playoffs.
Yeah,
so
that's
I think
true.
It would be, you know.
Now, you could also still have your 4-5 and 3-6 series open while these other guys are battling it out.
Huh. Okay.
How about that?
Well, yeah, and then though you're on different schedules with all these.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it would even put the 1 and the 2 seeds at disadvantage to have to like catch up.
Potentially,
because
they're squeezing
frequently.
In more games. Yeah.
I think they probably would just maybe end the regular season on that Sunday beforehand and then have it go those next like 2-3 days or so. I mean, I guess it would be what maximum or minimum 3 days is what it would take.
Yeah, because you'd have 7 in it play 8 and 9 play 10 on the same day. Then you'd want a travel day in between, and then you'd have the winner of the one play the loser of the other.
Yeah. I mean, they might even be able to do it on a back-to-back, frankly, because it's same conference, right? So, I mean, that would suck, but
in the West, I don't – maybe you could do that in the East. In the West, boy, I don't see how you pull that off.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. You back-to-backs are not – you know, New Orleans to Golden State or something like that.
And just with the team's logistics, like you got to have a hotel booked and stuff. I question that one.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's plenty of room at you know, the Super 8 by the airport, right? Like players would be fine with that. Yeah. So I think, you know, there's a couple of components here. I think the anti-tanking is a good thing, and they've taken care of the tanking at the very bottom of the lottery most of the way. I think teams actually almost don't. It's still important to have the worst record because at least you limit your downside. I think teams kind of forgot about that maybe last year.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so if you do that now, of course, more of the tanking takes place in the middle, but maybe, you know, having the 10th seed be eligible for this quote unquote playoffs, you know, might be good. And then, if for those who are worried about, you know, okay, let's say the 7th seed wins 12 more games than the 10th seed. That's about what it was last year between the Spurs and the Lakers.
Mm-hmm.
That you still would have to, if you're the 7th or 8th seed, you still would have to lose 2 games to be out. You know, and I think that's enough and one of them would be a home game.
The 7th seed would have to lose twice at home, which,
yeah. But, you know, maybe if it's a, and I hate to, bring up Memphis again, but like your 2016 team that, you know, had all those injuries and just had no business being in the playoffs. Like, I wouldn't mind to see like a team like that. You know, we have one of those every couple of years, just, you know, not win that play-in tournament and end up, you know, out of the playoffs. I mean, I think you at least,
I'm not sure we would have minded either based on how those 4 games in San Antonio went. But.
No, that's actually, did I tell you that I didn't watch a single minute of that series?
Oh, I don't play. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly like Detroit Milwaukee last year. I didn't watch any of that.
Oh yeah, no, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't do any Dunked Ons for that series, and I didn't do any because Blake Griffin was out too in that series.
Yeah,
and I didn't
exactly.
do any Dunked Ons for that Grizz Spurs series. I was like, hey, you know what? I'm gonna not watch this game. If it's close, I'll go back and I'll rewatch it, and I can talk about it on the show. And lo and behold, the games weren't close. So
there was one game where we had it down to like 14 in the second half. I'm surprised you didn't spend more time on that.
So, okay, let's do this. Give me on a 1 to 10 scale how in favor you are of these three changes. First of all, the
conference semifinal reseed.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll give it like a solid 8. I think that's generally pretty good. It presents one or two maybe small logistical hurdles, but generally I'm in favor.
Yeah, I'm about a 6 or 7, if only because I grew up with this idea of you have the behemoth in your conference that you're always trying to overcome to get to the finals that you know. Like, I enjoy the year to year of, we got to go through these guys. You know, Houston trying to go through Golden State these last few years. To New York trying to go through Chicago. Chicago trying to go through Detroit. Detroit trying to go through Boston. So I will kind of miss that aspect of it a little bit. But, you know, I think overall having a better finals is more important and more important for the league overall. So the midseason tournament.
I'll give it like a 6. Hey, I'm sort of interested in it. I think it has a chance to work.
Why the hell not? Yeah, I think it's the regular season can't get any worse, at least, right? Yeah. Like, it'll give schlubs like me and you who need something to talk about around.
It'll provide content. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Now you're getting to the real story. Extra content.
That's it. Yeah.
Here we go. Tournament. My midseason tournament preview will be up.
Yeah, I mean that'll probably determine a lot of it too. You know, is the media going to cover it like it actually matters? It probably will. Why not? You know, yeah. it's more interesting.
You know, it's a bracketed tournament too, which, you know, I've heard that people gamble on tournaments like that.
I'm gonna go with the 7. I'm getting like more interested in it, as time goes on here. Okay. And then, the third thing was the play-in tournament.
Yeah. I'm kind of lukewarm on that.
Yeah.
I still feel like it's a way for a team to kind of get jobbed out of a playoff spot that they mostly earned.
Yeah. I mean, to have now 2/3 of the league basically kind of, I mean, not in the playoffs, but like close enough. Also, like, I mean, if you want to look at the NCAA tournament, the playing games are just like the dumbest thing ever. Now that's a 64 team tournament. So it's like, do you really need more teams in there? I'd say I'll give it a 5. I'm willing to give it a chance. And I will say this too, by the way, part of the reason why I think this is good is think of how miserable, even with teams like fighting for playoff spots, how many of those games were there fighting down the end to get into the playoffs are against teams that are just totally tanking or resting or not trying. Like, think of how many times we're like, you'd think it would be an awesome pennant race to get in at the end. And, you know, Brooklyn doesn't even send their guys to Chicago, and 2017 Miami has no chance because Chicago wins by 50, you know, or, OKC has to get in at the end and Milwaukee plays 5 guys. Tim Frazier plays all 48 minutes and they play a 2-3 zone the entire game. You know, like, you won't see that. Hopefully, I mean, you might see that at least as far as like at the very end before this tournament, but that's not your last vision of the end of the regular season. Like, I used to, when we started doing this podcast, like, we've seen it evolve over time. I loved doing this podcast for the last 2-3 games of the regular season and remembering all this stuff. And like, you know, 2015, San Antonio lost on the final day at New Orleans, and then they got stuck with the Clippers, and they lost to the Clippers. So they didn't have home court, you know, like that.
That also gave us home court and gave us Portland, who had lost like half their team. So that was a very memorable game for me.
So, yeah, you know, I think I'll go 6 on that too. I mean, now implementing all of these changes that are maybe, you know, a 6 or a 7, and there's so many of them that maybe it's hard to gauge the impact of each individual one. That's a concern too. But I guess I like it all the most because it presages perhaps taking the regular season down to fewer games. Like, this is the first time they'd be doing that. And now they could really keep chopping it off, especially if, you know, maybe regular season ratings even go up a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that'll be great. And you did raise an important part. It's not just the abject tanking of we're trying to lose on purpose. It is the low key sort of our games just don't matter anymore, so we're just not going to play our best players and put them at risk. I think that's the more insidious form that really infects the league in March. And this does help deal with that when, I mean, one of the, I'm looking at the Eastern Conference standings right now, like one of these teams is going to be 10th, right? And I don't think they're going to pull away from the other ones, you know? So there's going to be a lot more incentive for these teams at the bottom, I think, to try at least a little bit.
Well, and there'll also be perhaps, I mean, there's usually a lot of incentive anyway to get six because there's usually a pretty big drop off between the first two teams in a conference to third, especially when you're dealing with.
It's going to make that 6-7 race very valuable. I agree with that.
Yeah. Especially just to get, I think.
Because even if you get in as seven, you have one bad day and you're knocked down to eight and now you're playing the one seed.
And I think the other thing that's nice too is that you're going to, the good teams will get like almost a full week off before the playoffs. Like, so they'll be ready to go. You're really only getting in some cases 2 days off. It's like just a continuation of the season.
Which,
like, you get a break.
Which should mean we'll see fewer playoff teams resting their players on the last day of the regular season.
Yeah.
In games that they might need to win.
And because, you don't want a guy to have like 10 days off or something if you know.
Yeah, that's actually too many days off is actually bad. Yeah, exactly. Right. So I think that'll be maybe a small piece of positivity from this.
All right, you going to do a couple of mailbag questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, what interested you? We had some leftover from my Dunked On mailbag, so I threw a few in that I thought might be interesting for you. What'd you like there?
Okay, reader Jeffrey Lynn 94 asks, which rookie extensions are looking good and which ones are teams starting to regret? What do you think, Nate?
Oh, Jaylen Brown's looking better. And that was probably the diciest one. I think DeJounte Murray, despite the Spurs struggles, he looks like he's back athletically. So I think that one is looking pretty good.
Yeah, his movement seems fine to me. Like, he's pushing the ball up the court and everything. And his shot's always going to be a little bit of a question mark. I think they need to get players with him who actually like to play in transition. But I think that's going to be okay.
I got one for you.
Okay.
Ben Simmons, 5-year maximum extension.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah, Ben Simmons slander has been a popular topic lately. You know, we saw people talking about whether Ingram was the best player from that draft now. Is that even the worst max?
Yeah, well, with Murray being the other
one. What about Jamal Murray?
Yeah, he. But that was one that I think, you know, Simmons is like, oh, this is a no-brainer, you know, and I think it's at least the way he started. Oh, well, he did hit a corner three. Like, let's, ring the Liberty bell for that one. But, he's got to actually stand out there and shoot it. And if he does that 50 more times, then maybe I'll start to believe in it. But it's just, it's so hard to fit around him. I mean, and he really is in the half court an offensive liability. Like, there's his, I talked about this on Dunkdown last week. Like, his post up numbers are terrible. He's run 7 pick and rolls all season as of a couple of days ago and has 0 points and 5 turnovers and 4 offensive fouls on those pick and rolls per synergy. Now maybe on another team that was totally built around him the way Giannis is, he might look better, but especially for this team, the max.
That's what I get back to. He does, on a team where Joel Embiid is the best player, Simmons is a suboptimal fit. Does he have max contract trade value though? Like, he was going to get a max contract from somebody. Do you agree with me on that?
Even if he played the way he's played right now all year. Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, like, someone would have given it to him, just because of the talent that he has. He's already made an all-star team. I mean, just simply having that all-star designation next to your name, you know, Kevin Pelton did some research on this years ago that just in and of itself, like, increases your contract. So, you know, was he going to get a max? Yes. Did they have much choice? No. Is it going to look like a good contract in a couple of years with the lack of improvement and, in fact, regression in a number of areas that he's had? You know, that's what I begin to question. I mean, it certainly looks worse than the day it was signed. And that was kind of the thrust of the question.
I would definitely agree with that. Yes. I would say, on the other hand, that Pascal Siakam's contract is looking outstanding right now.
Yeah, I mean, maybe their only regret is it's not 5 years.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure they wish they could have done the full 5 now. Although, correct me if I'm wrong. I think you have to go full max to get the 5 now.
Yeah. No. But they did go full max for 4. So in theory, you would go full max for five. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Milwaukee sure wishes that they would have just gone the full 5-year max for Giannis instead of going for the 4 years, even though they did get, I think, you know, about a $6-7 million discount off the max at that time. All right,
They also got no player option, which was probably the most critical thing of all.
Yeah. Okay, this is a quick one here.
Okay.
Michael Yee at Raps in 4. How much is Fred VanVleet getting this offseason? Currently makes just under $10 million per year on that 2-year deal he signed as a restricted free agent a couple years ago.
Well, I would say mid-tier starting point guards, or people whose teams thought they were getting mid-tier starting point guards anyway, got in the high teens last summer. I think that number may go up a little bit. I would say $20 million would be my ballpark for Fred VanVleet.
Yeah, it's interesting. So he'll be 26 this offseason. His defensive versatility and ability to switch, he's just such a bulldog out there. And what he did in the finals, defending and now being the starter with Lowry out. I mean, he's pretty powerless from two-point range, but he can shoot the ball off the dribble. He can nash under the basket. I mean, he's definitely a quality starting point guard. You know, he's probably between, you know, your 15th and 20th best point guard in the NBA, exactly. I would say.
Yeah.
And moreover, he's the only guy that I right now project to be a starter over the life of his new contract. You know, maybe Mike Conley, if he starts playing a lot better, but if he keeps playing like this, he probably just opts into his $34 million for next year.
You could take your Conley slander right out of here, Nate. Right out of here with that. I'm not hearing it.
You're still driving the Conley most improved player bandwagon?
I think it's going to be a hard slog to get to that, but...
I thought he would be a lot better too. I admit that, but
it's been the adjustment for him is playing with Rudy rather than playing with Mark. They're two completely different kinds of pick and roll partner, and it's a completely different read. So you could see him the last few games picking it up more, where he's not throwing the pass as he's not throwing the bounce pass to him at the free throw line quite as quickly. He's looking more to hang on to the ball and throw the lob late.
Yeah,
and so, but it's going to be an adjustment for him, and I totally underestimated that.
Yeah, and I think I've seen him miss shooters a little bit more than because you know
what shooters could he have missed with us?
Yeah, no, that was beat me to the joke.
Oh, there, I beat you to the punchline.
But sorry. No, I mean I think he's getting better, and obviously his shooting struggles at the beginning of the year were something that you don't expect to continue necessarily. He's gradually getting back into it. But anyway, back to VanVleet. The question to me is, you know, he's not restricted, but where does the money come from? And you're looking at Toronto's plan being on that 2021 plan. As of now, they've got about $57 million in space. They would want to have max room. If they go $20 million a year for VanVleet, you're getting pretty darn close to that. Now, that would include the cap hold for Ananobi. I mean, they could find a way to do it. They could get off of Powell or stretch him or something to get to the max room. So which of these other teams that has space is going to go to that kind of level, though? Where is the leverage to extract that kind of a deal? Maybe the Knicks, if they just decide that they really want to get better.
What about Minnesota?
Yeah, but they don't have any money.
Yet.
I guess that's true. I think he'd be a pretty – I mean, they already got Tyus Jones. I think he actually would work pretty well in Memphis, too. I want to see how well Ja and Jaren Jackson take a because he could play backup point guard. He could also play next to Ja because he can guard shooting guards. I mean, that level of versatility to play on or off the ball and guard, you know, 1 through 2 and even switch some beyond that, I mean, that's – incredibly valuable on a good team.
You don't think of a short guard being able to do that, but he's a bowling ball. Like, he's strong. He just gets under you and it just creates leverage and it's hard to get a good shot off against him.
Yeah. So it really does seem though, like Knicks and Memphis are the only teams that as of now have big cap space that would be interested there. So, you know, maybe they kind of come to an agreement. That's in the high teens. Then what happens with Lowry too, as well? I mean, this could be a very interesting question.
Lowry's an important domino in all that because that extension really set himself up to be traded if something good comes up. So he's going to be a player worth watching, definitely.
All right, so
you don't think Detroit would go after Fred VanVleet? You got Dwayne Casey there. I mean, obviously, it depends a little on what happens with Drummond.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he's going to have a big market in Charlotte. But he could opt out, and that would open up about $35 million in room for them if he were to opt out. So that's they definitely need a solution at that position. Derrick Rose has played very well, but he's just so limited in the number of minutes that he can play, and VanVleet would be a good fit next to Rose.
Yeah, Rose to me is really a two at this point anyway.
Yeah. Okay, let's do a little Holland Journeys to wrap up here. And I wanted to talk to you about your player development article and that topic in general. You wrote a nice piece on The Athletic about how the Blazers and Nuggets have developed players, San G League. So when you I'll give you the floor here. What works and what doesn't work as far as player development?
I think that's still a little bit of a mystery, and that was one of the reasons I pursued this story.
Yeah. Well, I remember once you said, and this might have even been before you joined the group. Well, obviously it was because you wrote it. Before you joined the Grizzlies, that gifting players minutes, you didn't, at least as of that time, didn't believe that that worked.
And I think it's almost secondary that some of these teams have been able to have these guys in their system for a year or two and then just pull them out of the woodwork and start playing them. And they're good. And you're like, wait, how did that happen? And I think a lot of it is just the time in the gym with developing the ability to read the game and developing just the skill work, working on guys with their shooting in game situations, shooting the types of shots they'll need to make in the games, whether it's like, you know, those one-handed pick the ball up scoops on their pick and roll drive for the point guards, or different shots that a big might need to make that are completely different shots than 10 years ago. And I think the best teams at it really focus on those situations that these guys are going to be in and are able to drill those situations without necessarily needing to get a ton of 5-on-5 minutes. Because for the secondary players, I think it's harder for them to develop without a good program behind them. Like somebody who is good enough to have the ball in his hands a lot from the moment he gets in the league, it's much easier for that guy to develop because he's just going to get so many reps. But the secondary guys, I think it's a lot harder, and I think there has to be a lot more intention behind a program. And it's so hard to lose sight of it during the season. It's one of those things that in July everybody talks about being so important, and then right around this time, like, oh man, we're 4-12. You know, I don't have time to work with my 13th man on his jump shot. You know, we gotta watch some film and devise new plays and get our veterans some rest. Like everything else comes first. And it's hard to still have the player development come first during those 6 months of season where your just head is spinning and the season comes at you so fast with the games. You really don't have a ton of on-court time in between. So maximizing that and B, still having it be a priority when you get to this point in the season is so important. I think that's what the better teams are able to do. And I think that supersedes things like just having a G League team.
Yeah, I a couple points there. I think one, to me, and I don't know this to be true, I haven't empirically studied it, it would be very difficult to do so. But when I watch teams work out, and just sort of anecdotally to me too, the good teams, and Denver is one of these, when the guys work out, it looks closer to a game, whether that's game speed, whether that's shooting the shots that you're going to shoot in a game, whether it's, setting up a 3-on-3 game where you're making the reads that you're going to have to make on both offense and defense, actually fucking working on defense. Obviously all I get to see is, you know, what they're doing before a game. I don't get to see.
You can tell a lot watching a team between 4:30 and 5:30. You absolutely can. Yeah. There's no question.
That's why I always get there early to watch that. That's my favorite time to sit down at 4:30 and just you know, I'm sure everyone's weirded out by me just sitting next to them watching their practice when there's nobody else in the arena. But yeah, you can learn a ton from that.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's my favorite hour too. And even now I like going down for that, and there'll be all personnel scouts from other teams and me, and just having a little party watching what they're doing. It's very interesting.
So you mentioned the G League. I think they have way too many games in the G League that I don't know why they try to make it like the NBA travel schedule. The NBA travel schedule is ridiculous. They also actually, it could be a little bit of a lab to just see if like the gate increases for some of those teams to have fewer games. You know, I know it's only a 50 game season, but
I think you need actual demand before the supply demand thing really comes into play.
I realize they're not, you know, like the Santa Cruz Warriors do okay. I mean, there's like a few.
There's a few teams that do okay and might be somewhat interesting to study, but I know it's in South Haven, Mississippi. It wouldn't matter if we played one day or 365.
Yeah, I guess there's a reason that G League Showcase has like no fans invited at all.
Literally, by definition now.
Yeah. But the point I was going to make is when you're sending guys down there to the G League, like it's hard enough during an NBA season when you have at least like the perks of being in the NBA to like actually keep up with, say, nutrition and weightlifting and stuff. Like, why don't they just have like, you know, 1.5 games a week or 2 games a week at most? To where, and especially when you have to travel from, you know, Sioux Falls to
Prescott, Arizona.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like you would know better than I am what the ridiculous travel is there. It's gotten a little bit better as teams have kind of made their teams closer to their home base. But so like, why not just have, you know, 1.5 games a week in the G League so you can actually really practice and. Like, you don't need that many games. I mean, it's for just like statistical sample size. Like, what's the reason? And just this is make it closer to the NBA, like make everyone miserable, just like they are in the NBA from traveling. Like, I really don't understand why you wouldn't just have way fewer games so players can really work on their body and their skill development.
It gets back to the question of why is this league here, right? Is it a minor league like the old CBA, or is it a developmental league like they called it in the beginning, right? Because I think you're right that if you're doing development, you probably want to play even fewer games than you play now. Because they still have their share of back-to-backs, and some of the back-to-backs are ugly. Like 7 p.m. game, 4 p.m. the next day, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and so, you're flying commercial, so you're not leaving right after the game. You're getting up for a 6 a.m. flight to get there the same day.
Yeah. Or even if it's a regular back to back, you could still, we had in Memphis home road back to back with a G League team where the next morning you're taking 2 flights to go from Memphis to Des Moines, which isn't that far on a map, but there's no direct flight. So you gotta, you're spending the whole day just traveling there.
So you're in agreement with me that you should reduce the number of games?
I think that is an outstanding proposal. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So last thing here.
But the numbers guy in me does want the large sample size still.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you're trying to bring these guys in to be role players, and you're just like, yeah. How the hell do I know if this guy's
how do I evaluate off of 8 games, right? Could I have about 20 more? Yeah. So that's always challenging.
Yeah. So I've always thought, and it sounds like the Nuggets are in close. Another difference, and this was noted too in your piece, is that, you know, actually having guys who are kind of basketball players on your player development coaching staff who can challenge these guys a little bit is actually a good thing. I always felt like if I were running a team and I had carte blanche, I would get, you know, basically a 9-man coaching staff and have a couple of extras even of basically guys who maybe even aren't really coaches, but we're just going to call them coaches and are almost like players. And then maybe we even tell their agents, wink, wink, like, hey, we might sign one of you guys if, you know, we have a roster spot or something like that. But, you know, guys who can like be in practice all the time. And we just say, we're going to put this player in there with 9 other players and we're just going to put them in the lab. I call it the lab. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to run these plays. And then the other thing you would gain too is maybe an idea just in general of like what works in basketball. Like you could try out new plays, have those guys run it when, you know, your practice time with your actual players is so limited. Do a bunch of stuff where you can just like move guys around on a chessboard, either for your player development or to just learn something about how certain strategies would work in basketball, right? You could try, you know, your Vivek run a Dive 4-on-5 if you wanted to, and then mm-hmm. have it hopefully never become public.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Are there any, like, is there any reason you couldn't do that? Or is there any reason that that's just a dumb idea?
It's just a question of numbers and logistics to me. I mean, you look like all the video coordinators that have been hired in the last few years all just happen to be like 6'7", 220 and played Division II, you know, like that kind of background. And there's a reason teams are doing that. So there's definitely been an increase in that type of hire. I don't know if it's to the point where teams have an entire squadron capable of playing 5-on-5, but we're definitely getting more to that point in play. And I mean, Denver isn't the first team either to have former players on their staff who can work out players.
Sure.
But I think it does help just to really play against some people who at least have some modicum of similar talent, where it's not just a 5'7" assistant coach that you're shooting shots over.
Yeah, I wouldn't even mind it if, especially with a shorter G League season, you could have your G League players and your NBA players actually practice together. Like you can't, like the way the CBA is now, like you can't practice unless you're like signed to an NBA contract in theory and be a player. I mean, I guess you could be on the coaching staff, but there does seem like it's a little bit antiquated to not be able to like do this.
Yeah,
this
you have to assign your young guys to the G League practice is basically what you have to do right now. And I mean, I can see some reasons for wanting it that way, but there definitely have been situations where, God, if you just had one G League guy who could play this one position where you have three guys out, your whole practice would be 50% better. So,
yeah.
And we've definitely been in those situations. So that would be a welcome change. So they won't put it in the next CBA. You know why they won't put it in the next CBA? Because it'll get negotiated at the last minute. And so they won't have time to deal with stuff like that. But it's something that they ought to.
Yeah. All right. Well, something that you guys ought to do is listen to John get us out of here right now. I forgot to do that last week, but make sure to tell him to rate and review and all that stuff, John.
All right. Thanks everyone for joining me and Nate. You can make sure you subscribe our, let's try that shit again.
Oh man, I'm going to leave this in. This is great. This is great stuff. Well, I totally fucked you by saying rate and review, because then like your natural inclination is, I don't want to say the exact words that he just said. So I'll take some responsibility for that flub personally.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already so you can get every single episode, and make sure to rate and review us at iTunes or Spotify or wherever you find your podcasts.
Oh, that was fantastic. No ums, no nothing. That was like, maybe I should just record that and I'll just append it to the end of
every single episode.
We don't have to put you through this anymore. All right. Thanks so much. We'll talk to y'all next time.